Our next speaker, Dr. Yvonne Kangriga, heads up our anesthesia liver surgery, liver transplant team, and he's going to talk to us today about anesthetic techniques in the cirrhotic patient, techniques for optimizing outcomes. Yvonne?
Thank you very much. I'm thankful to the college and in particular to Drs. Maynard and Chapman for the kind invitation. I will share with you some anesthetic considerations for the cirrhotic surgical patient today. I have no relevant financial relationships for this talk, and as a way of introducing this topic, I'd say that perioperative teams are more likely to encounter a cirrhotic patient than ever before. And this is because the incidence of cirrhosis is increasing of the disease, and also because of the increased longevity of these patients due to improved medical and surgical treatments. So surgery in these patients is associated with higher morbidity and mortality, it's critical for perioperative physicians to understand the pathophysiology of the disease and the extrahepatic manifestation, really, of liver disease. It's a case in point. This is a short series from our institution of four patients who were on the liver transplant list who underwent a balloon aortic valvuloplasty in 2014 successfully and went on to have a liver transplant. One of the patients died about 1 month after the liver transplant from sepsis. But if you look at the MELD score was in three of these patients very high, 36 to 38. And I think that the improvement in the minimally invasive surgery and in understanding of the underlying pathophysiology and perioperative care allowed this that probably I think that even one decade earlier, we would not be thinking that we would be fixing an aortic valve in patients with a MELD of 38. So what does an anesthesiologist, how do you conceptualize what an anesthesiologist thinks in terms of intraoperative care goals? I would think that in terms of compensated cirrhosis, the goals would be to ensure the perfusion and oxygen delivery to the liver, to prevent any further decline in the function of the liver, certainly to avoid hepatotoxic drugs, and to manage comorbidities. A good example would be to manage diabetes perioperatively in a patient with NAFLD. In the decompensating cirrhosis, in addition to this, the goals would be to manage the extrahepatic manifestation of end-stage liver disease, of which there are many, obviously. No organ system is spared in end-stage liver disease. I will focus this talk on bleeding and hemostasis in liver disease and some of the anesthetic interventions that can mitigate this. So the transfusion is associated with increased mortality and morbidity. We know that it's associated with sepsis, renal injury, TRIM, trally, and mortality. Cirrhotic patients are traditionally assumed hypocoagulable based on the conventional tests, and it is still reported that preemptive transfusion based on the tests and in the absence of bleeding is fairly common. So I will ask three questions here in this presentation. One is cirrhosis a hypocoagulable state? The second one is, what are the appropriate tests for perioperative monitoring and managing hemostasis in the cirrhotic patient? And finally, what are some of the intraoperative anesthetic strategies that can mitigate this, in particular the hemostatic and the hemodynamic approach? There is abundance of evidence that the conventional coagulation tests do not predict or correlate with bleeding in the cirrhotic patient. And this is true for a number of, these are literally thousands of patients presented in this slide. This is true for somewhat minimally invasive procedures, but also true in liver transplantation. So why is this? I will get to the point. One of the reasons is that it was not recognized for a long time that thrombus generation in cirrhosis can be preserved despite of abnormal conventional coagulation tests. And in this landmark study, really, by an Italian team led by Tripodi, they have shown that when thrombomodulin in the pair on the right-hand side, when thrombomodulin is added to the thrombin generation test, that the thrombin generation in controls and in cirrhosis is comparable. So why is this? So our conventional tests, such as PT and PTT, look at only at the procoagulant pathway, which is the left portion of this big cascade, from the moment that factor 7 interacts with a tissue factor, which is exposed with endothelial injury. This elicits the procoagulant cascade, resulting in thrombin and then fibrinogen to fibrin transformation. However, these tests do not look at the anticoagulant tests, and by adding thrombomodulin, which is a cofactor for thrombin and which is expressed by the damaged endothelium, we elicit also the anticoagulant part of this cascade. The thrombin-thrombomodulin complex, as seen in the lower panel here, activate protein C and protein S, and that leads now to downregulation of thrombin. The other two anticoagulant factors that are not considered also are antithrombin and tissue factor pathway inhibitor. So actually, in liver disease, both the procoagulant and the anticoagulant portion or component of the pathway are equally decreased. Only with PT-PTT, we're not detecting the anticoagulant pathway. So they are in balance. This balance has been now shown at the level of primary hemostasis, at the level of coagulation, and also the level of fibrinolysis. I will just mention that a lower platelet count and increased nitric oxide and prostacycline that inhibit platelets are offset with a huge increase in von Willebrand factor because of the decreased synthesis of the enzyme that cleaves it, and also increase in factor 8, which is protected by the von Willebrand factor. So in fact, you can have a hypercoagulable state with cirrhosis. So the new concept really is not that of a hypocoagulable hemostasis, but rather of a rebalanced hemostasis in cirrhosis. The balance is somewhat fragile, which is depicted on the right-hand panel, and processes that may, or diseases that may tip this balance easily are renal failure, infections, SBP, that can tip this balance towards bleeding, and likewise there are conditions that are known to be associated with hypercoagulability, such as HCC, NASH, and the biliary disease. So you can have a patient that has an INR of 2, who is actually hypercoagulable, and where it would be really wrong trying to correct any kind of numbers, lab numbers. So we've seen that the cirrhosis is not necessarily a hypocoagulable state. We also saw that INR is a good predictor of survival through MELD and through CTP score, but not of the clotting function. The viscoelastic tests are better, are more accurate, and are used in many facilities who deal with patients with end-stage liver disease. These tests are also available in many large academic institutions that do trauma and CT surgery. And the two examples in the industry are Rotem and TEG that are comparable technologies. What is good about this technology is that it gives you a real-time kinetics of the clot formation and lysis. Clot formation here, maximal strength of the clot, which is expressed by the amplitude of this tracing, and then lysis. And in fact, there is a good correlation of the strength of the clot, even at 10 minutes, with platelet function and with the fibrinogen. So it's a very rapid test, and it's ideal for the point of care. So the advantages of this, the other advantages of these technologies are that Rotem and TEG can dissect the contribution of fibrinogen and platelets to the strength of the clot, which is depicted here, can be chemically dissected. It can delineate also the role of the clotting factors, also detect fibrinolysis and effects of heparin, and uniquely or certainly compared to INR and PT, can actually detect hypercoagulability. So because these technologies have these discrete parameter values and are developing in real time, they're ideal for the protocol-driven interventions. So what is the clinical evidence for any kind of benefit from these technologies? I could find only, most of these data, I have to say, much like Dr. Maynard stated before, come from transplant literature. And in the case of the viscoelastic testing, this is true too. So I could find only one randomized controlled trial of using TEG, one of the viscoelastic technology in managing hemostasis in patients undergoing a number of low risk of bleeding procedures, but also some higher risk procedures such as hepatic resection, some other abdominal surgery that was not specified in this study, and thoracotomy. So patients were randomized to either a TEG-driven protocol based on the parameters, or their standard of care, which was fairly liberal. They were transfusing with FFP all patients with INR 1.8 and platelets, which is reasonable at numbers of 50 or higher. So what these researchers found in this is a 60-patient randomized controlled trial, was that in the standard of care group, all of the patients per their liberal protocol received either FFP or platelets, and in the TEG-driven protocol, only 17% of the patients. There was no difference, however, in the red blood cell transfusion or survival. So their conclusion was that a transfusion based on the lab values is excessive and potentially harmful. And here is some of the explanations why it's potentially harmful. Loading up a patient of CTP, maybe class B or C, loading with FFP to correct coagulopathy may require 10 to 30 milliliters per kilo, and it will not be very effective below the INR 1.7 or so. The problem with this is that the volume, preferentially in higher MELD and in higher CTP score patients, goes into the splanking compartment, non-central compartment, where it increases portal hypertension and leads to splanking congestion and actually can lead to spontaneous rupture. This is a randomized controlled trial that exemplifies this concept. In the setting of upper GI bleed, this research team from Spain looked at two protocols, a restrictive transfusion protocol targeting hemoglobin of 7 versus a liberal targeting hemoglobin of 9, transfusing patients where hemoglobin went below 9. And they found that in liberal transfusion, there was more volume given, there was more volume overload, there was worsening portal hypertension, more bleeding, and in the end, there was increased 45-day mortality. Using viscoelastic tests in liver transplantation, I think there's a common theme, really, that there is a beneficial effect on the blood loss and transfusion, but most of the studies did not report any significant outcome difference, and there are very few randomized control studies. One exception is the Spanish study that showed that in addition to a reduction in transfusion, they also had some outcome differences where they had less postoperative bleeding, less takebacks, and importantly reduced the AKI from 17 to 2%. Another approach that was published in Europe is using the viscoelastic tests protocols and factor concentrates that are more common in Europe than in the United States. In this particular study, all patients received antifibrinolytics and coagulation was managed by a Rotem protocol using fibrinogen concentrates or prothrombin complex concentrate. And only as a second line of treatment, they were using FFP. Cryoprecipitate is not available, actually, in Germany, so this was not even a part of the protocol. What this team found was that they gave fibrinogen to 57% of the patients and prothrombin complex concentrates to 35%. They had a nice sparing effect when it came to FFP. 85% of the patients did not receive FFP, and I think somewhat less impressive outcome with 70% of the patients not receiving platelets and 37% not receiving red blood cells, which is more in line with what other centers report. Importantly, the thrombogenic potential was not really much out of line. I think that a hepatic artery thrombosis rate of 4.5 and portal vein thrombosis of 0.4 is in line with other centers, particularly considering that this was an IVC replacement technique in these patients. will not spend much time on the complex concentrates, but just to say that this is a there is not much use here in the United States. I think we have a higher use of the fibrinogen concentrate than the PCCs, but some advantages are certainly the lower volume of these compounds. An example is that 50 milliliters of fibrinogen concentrate equals 5 units of FFP, 1 liter. So I think there is some, in conjunction with a lower infectious risk and the no need for cross-matching, I think that these are some of the advantages of the concentrates. I think we need more safety data for this to become mainstream practice. One more just note on hypercoagulability. It's now known that there were large studies that showed that cirrhosis is actually a prothrombotic state, and the large studies showed that there is more thrombosis in liver in cirrhosis than in the matched controlled patients. In liver candidates, up to 25% of the candidates may have portal vein thrombosis, and post-liver transplant, there are significant rates, 3 to 5% or 2 to 3% for hepatic artery or portal vein, respectively. Rotem or TEG can be predictive of this, and on the right-hand side of this picture is a TE from our operating room showing a clot at the junction of IVC and right atrium that actually had a hemodynamic effect. And in this patient, the INR was actually 1.6, and the thromboelastogram was consistent with hypercoagulability. I'd like to spend just a few minutes at the end talking about the hemodynamic interventions that may affect bleeding. In liver surgery, we know that a low CVP is an accepted concept to reduce bleeding. And there is concern that low cardiac output caused by the low CVP and the use of vasopressors to maintain the pressure may result in organ hyperperfusion. In general population, the large retrospective study did not establish any risk for renal damage or any other organ damage. I could find only in 3 out of 8 randomized controlled trials that were part of the meta-analysis by Hughes, that three included cirrhotic patients, 20 to 40% of the patients were cirrhotic, but there was no subset analysis really for cirrhotic patients in this. I think it would be of interest to know whether cirrhotic liver and cirrhotic patients are equally tolerant of these hemodynamic interventions. Similarly, in the laparoscopic liver resection, low CVP has been reported in cirrhotics and also in patients with portal hypertension, and the outcomes seem to be favorable. In the end-stage liver disease, the hemodynamic picture is more complex. The hyperdynamic circulation can be modeled as a dual circulation, where this planking component is that of very high capacitance and low resistance. And this is really the surgeon's view of the patient that is very congested and prone to bleeding because of transecting of all the collaterals, whereas the peripheral component, including kidney and brain notably, is vasoconstricted and with high resistance and low capacitance. The anesthesiologist's view, including maybe an empty heart and low filling pressure. So one of the common, some of the common interventions in end-stage renal disease to minimize bleeding, to minimize this vascular congestion, are low fluid regimens, fluid restriction, and the use of vasoconstrictors such as the vasopressin, V1 antagonists, and adrenergic antagonists to centralize this volume, to shift it from the splanking component into the central circulation. So clearly, using this agonist in the presence of renal vasoconstriction poses concern. So what are the data? Well, there is here also a common theme. I think that there are also mixed results. The common theme is that the low CVP concept, which is also applied in liver transplant surgery, is in most studies this applying fluid restriction and pressors results in reduction of estimated blood volume and transfusion. But the outcomes are somewhat different. In the two randomized control studies, there was actually a high incidence of hemodialysis in both the control and the experimental arm. And In the other study, there was actually 6% of pulmonary edema, and one may wonder, why is there pulmonary edema in patients with low CVP? There is actually an explanation for that, potentially. In a two-center study in the United States, low CVP versus usual care, there was a huge reduction in transfusion requirements in the low CVP arm, but there was also a higher incidence of hemodialysis and actually higher mortality. This was published in 2004. In contrast, the team led by Massicotte in Canada that has published extensively on this topic uses a fairly aggressive way of reducing central pressures by 40% using even phlebotomy in combination with pressors. That team reports a dramatic reduction of bleeding and finds that phlebotomy is actually protective of other bleeding, whereas the FFP predicts further transfusion. They did report improved survival, but their baseline survival was fairly low for the MELD. So I think with the improved survival, they're matching other centers. So how can we reconcile this, and what should we do in the end stage liver disease? Can we apply the low CVP concept in the end stage liver disease? I think probably yes in the low MELD patients. But in the high MELD patients, the circulatory disturbances are very complex, and the answer is not straightforward. It's more likely that we need some thoughtful goal-directed therapy, making sure that cardiac output is preserved and the organ perfusion is preserved. The other thing that is being recognized in the last several years and maybe up to a decade is cirrhotic cardiomyopathy, which has a very high prevalence in end-stage liver disease and is responsible for the rates of heart failure of up to 25% post-liver transplant with high mortality. Diastolic dysfunction is a very important component, and it's very elusive in terms of diagnosing. It's a very important component of the cirrhotic cardiomyopathy, and it is contributing to mortality after TIPS, heart failure after liver transplant, and also acute kidney injury and also graft failure. If you look at this pressure volume loop on the right, and you see that in diastolic dysfunction, there is a decreased stroke volume that is happening at the higher loading pressure. So the left ventricle is highly critically dependent on the right ventricular cardiac output. So to arbitrarily use any kind of cutoff numbers of lowering the CVP and lowering the cardiac output, lowering the preload of the left ventricle is probably not possible. And in fact, that may be the explanation for the case that I mentioned for the series that I mentioned where there was actually pulmonary edema in the low CVP group because of the probably diastolic heart failure. So the hemodynamic management in liver transplant in end-stage liver disease is challenging. There is no consensus on the best strategies or the monitoring modalities. I will conclude with this slide from the Lisman group from Holland, that I edited, that basically cirrhosis is not a hypocoagulable but rather a rebalanced state, that preemptively transfusing based on lab values, in particular conventional lab values, is probably not the right strategy. Rather, the strategy should be aimed at treating renal disease and infections, even dialyzing your patient before a procedure. Viscoelastic tests during the procedure are not ideal. They're not perfect, but they're the best we can, and they can drive certain protocols for managing hemostasis. CVP is a oversimplified concept that's probably applicable to low MELD patients, but not to patients with cirrhotic cardiomyopathy or end-stage liver disease because of their diastolic dysfunction. And finally, I think we should understand that liver disease is also actually a procoagulant, hypercoagulable disease, and I think we should be mindful of thromboprophylaxis throughout the whole perioperative period. So, thank you.